I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to Going Underground in the week of an unprecedented alliance between the Communist Party of China and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in the Gulf Cooperation Council. No wonder senior US officials urgently met with Chinese counterparts this week for so-called in-depth talks over Taiwan after the state visit of Chinese President Xi Jinping to Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh. This after OPEC Plus, including the UAE and the Saudi Arabians, refused Joe Biden's requests for more oil production to save NATO nations from the Ukraine proxy war. Joining me for today's episode to talk about whether there will be lasting, tragic repercussions for the USA in the new geopolitical landscape is renowned expert on China's foreign relations, Professor Huang Jing. He's the director of the Institute of the US and Pacific Studies at the Shanghai International Studies University, and he joins me from Berlin, where he's Richard von Weizsäcker Fellow at the Robert Bosch Academy. Thank you so much, Professor, for coming on. So it must have been important if hosts of the World Cup, Qatar officials had to attend and leave the World Cup. What does it signify? Because there's been relatively little press attention in NATO nation media, whereas the Global South has it as their third headline on all their news bulletins.
Of course, this is very significant. This is the first time, as far as I can remember, that Chinese topmost leaders, you know, go there to meet with leaders from Arabic countries. And you know, it's symbolic, but also has a lot of substance in it. It actually shows that both sides, China and the Arab countries, has a very strong common ground and a common interest to go in today's world, which is, we know there's war going on in Ukraine, also great competition going on between the United States and China. Of course, there's a great uncertainty about future. But this summit between China and Arabic countries or the Gulf Council has great significance, means that two sides really really want to join hands and to bring some public goods to both sides. I think that is great. Of course, the World Cup is a great thing, and everybody enjoys it.
It's a bit echoey there in Berlin, but we're not in an echo chamber. I know that, Professor, but as you know, think tanks, NGOs, they are arguably in echo chambers. We've heard from the Atlantic Council people saying that one shouldn't read too much significance in this, and others saying this is incredibly significant. The National Security Council spokesperson in Washington said, John Kirby said, "We are mindful of the influence that China is trying to grow around the world." And of course, this in the context of the fact that US agencies have already labeled China the number one enemy of the United States. Do you think there's a battle in Washington that's been won by those who see China as an enemy rather than as a partner to cooperate with for a more prosperous world?
There are some people, of course, in Washington, D.C. and the United States seeing China as a number one enemy or rival. But the official line of Washington, D.C. is that China is the most serious challenger to the U.S. and the U.S.-led international order. And that is the official line. If that's a challenger, of course, whatever China does, it will see a kind of lost United States, because people in Washington, D.C. try to see the U.S.-China competition as a zero-sum game, which I think is very underproductive, is very counterproductive. But of course, the United States of America, the people in Washington, D.C., will try to water down the significance of the summit. But the fact is a fact. I think it's, like I said just now, it has a great significance, both in terms of symbolic and in substance. After all, China, as a growing power, a number two power, and also number one trading power on Earth, need a kind of reliable supply of energy, which, you know, that's where the Gulf countries produce. On the other hand, the Gulf countries also need China as a major power to establish a new strategic balance in the region, because after a disintegration of Soviet Union, the U.S.-Israel alliance there has an overwhelming advantage. I think that's the very reason why there's no stability ever since. Of course, if China join in, given China's capacity or capability and also China's peaceful development strategy, I think will be a very positive element in the region, and also will help, in my view, in the long run, stabilize the situation there. Economically speaking, of course, China's One Belt, One Road initiative and other efforts will also kind of work right into the hand of the countries over there who try to restructure the economy so that its economy would not be solely dependent on energy industry, but become more diversified and more balanced in the future. As we know, the Saudis already have this 2030 strategy to develop. And of course, China's cooperation with China could be very, very productive and fruitful in this regard.
Well, okay, hundreds of millions of people from Latin America through Africa, through Southeast Asia, Russia and China may agree with what you're saying, but you know, in Europe and the United States, quite apart from the fact that the Saudis, the UAE, the Middle East is routinely condemned over human rights issues, China is routinely on the BBC and CNN and other television broadcasters as the gross human rights violator of them all, with concentration camps. I'm not sure quite how they argue the toss about the fact that Saudi Arabia is the guardian of the holy places of Islam, whilst China is supposed to simultaneously be anti-Muslim. But is the narrative lost in Europe and the United States?
This narrative has three problems. Number one problem is that it looks like the people who accuse China and other countries as human rights violations, it looks like they're the perfect. They don't have any problems. They don't have any violations of human rights, which is absolutely not true. If you look at history or at present, those people who accuse China, I mean the people in the United States and Europe, they have a very bloody history of violation of human rights. And the colonialism, slavery system, and so on and so forth, the genocide on the native people, like in America, United States of America and Australia and stuff like that. That's history. And even present, we see a lot of discriminations, a lot of violence, a lot of inequality, and the gap between rich and the poor, and so on. There's a lot of problems there, too. It's the first problem. Second problem, of course, in China, like in Riyadh, like in a lot of different countries, in Russia, of course, this country is not perfect. The system is not perfect. There are rooms that need to be improved down the road, because that's what we human beings trying to do. We try to improve ourselves so we can have a better future. That's not a problem. The problem is where we have the third one, that is a double standard. You cannot, accuse others while yourself seems to be perfect. This double standard sounds very hypocritical. That's why the United States and all those people has lost credibility. And they become more and more, I believe, a minority. Of course, this thing is not the majority, but you look at it, only 10% of global population are on this side. So to sum it up, my point is here. We as a human being, we're not perfect. Every society, under every political system, there are problems needs to be solved. There are improvement that we can, progress. But it is wrong, it is absolutely nonsense to say that I'm the one who are perfect, I have the moral high ground, you're the one who needs to be condemned, and also it's even worse to apply a kind of double standard on those issues. That will make all of us end up in a kind of more difficult and worse situations. This does not help.
You know the arguments, the intellectual arguments used against what you said. USAID, NGOs, they will say what you're engaged in there is whataboutism. And they're saying, well, we're not perfect. We know, they've overthrown 40 countries around the world in 50 years, their governments, and they're torturing, the British are torturing Julian Assange in London. We know all that. But it's worse somehow in the global south. That is their standard response. But isn't China losing the narrative partly because it seems to be arguing as if there are rational actors, arguing with rational actors, as it were? I mean, as you know, they've already said that China is the enemy number one. They send warships into the South China Sea, and There are continuous remarks from the United States. MI6 in London. China is the single greatest priority for MI6. China seeks to distort public discourse. The FBI boss, China is the biggest long-term threat to our economic and national security. Why does China behave so often in Europe and the United States as if they're going to somehow persuade Western capitals of their argument?
No, I think that it's very ironic and also sometimes even laughable for people who think that China is number one enemy. Of course, there are a lot of people here in Washington and in the West think China is a number one threat. And in that regard, China indeed seems to be a number one enemy. But on the other hand, we see that Joe Biden, President Joe Biden said just a few weeks ago in United Nations Assembly, he said, United States as a nation does not seek conflict with China, will not head into a Cold War with China, seek cooperation because of three C's as Biden administration policy towards China. Of course, number one is competition. Number two, of course, is confrontation if you have to. And number three is a cooperation in the areas that say common interest in Washington, D.C. too. So we seem to have two forces fighting against each other in Washington, D.C. and in the West in general. On the one hand, they see China's rise as a threat to their way of life. And on the other hand, they say there is a necessity and, of course, also a need to work with China on the kind of challenges we humankind are facing, like climate change, like non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, and now, of course, of global financial stability. And now they also want China to help to mediate or to bring an end to this bloody war in Ukraine. So it is a kind of self-contradictory element or phenomenon we see here in the West. Of course, China always carry on this peaceful development strategy. It's not just China just say that, but China is doing that, has been doing this for 40 years. In history, we know that in history, never before has a major power keep rising for 40 years without a single gunshot being fired outside China. That's amazing. That's a fact. That's a reality. We know that after Cold War, after the end of the Cold War, there are so many crises all over the world. The Kosovo crisis, Georgia crisis, Ukraine crisis, Syria crisis, or so on and so forth. But there are also crises in the Taiwan Strait, the crisis in South China Sea, the crisis between China and Japan over Diaoyu or Senkaku Island. But one fact everybody can see, all the crises, whenever the United States and the West get involved or play a major role, every one of them end up in a war, not a single exception. But for all those crises where China plays a major role, no single gunshot has been fired in the past 30 years.
Professor Huang Jing, I'll stop you there. More from the director of the Institute of the US and Pacific Studies at the Shanghai International Studies University after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I am still here with Professor Huang Jing from China's Shanghai International Studies University. Are there not cultural gunshots being fired all the time, making out that China is evil in any case? And China, I know it had some kind of exercise after Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, which was contrary to actual US foreign policy in terms of recognition of Taiwan as part of China. China just thought, well, we'll fire a few guns as some sort of practice. This while 400 military US bases encircle China. Just on this trip, they're talking about the petro-yuan and pricing oil in not in dollars. The Atlantic Council, others are trying to say, look, this isn't too big a deal. Other countries have done it. Of course, when other countries from the global south want to price oil in currencies other than the dollar, more than often than not, their leaders have been assassinated. What do you think are the dangers for China and for Saudi Arabia for talking openly about pricing oil in currencies other than the dollar?
The two issues just now in what you said. Number one is the Taiwan issue, Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, why China has launched such a large military operations or exercise around Taiwan. The island Taiwan actually is the largest ever since the Vietnam War ended. Of course, the second issue is that where China is going to use Chinese currency, that is RMB, to pay for the oil or to as a price to pay for the oil Chinese buy from Saudis. The first issue, of course, is very simple because United States adhere to what they said, one China policy, in which they recognize the People's Republic of China is the only legal representative, legitimate representative of whole China. And United States never ever recognized Taiwan as a sovereign state. And in that regard, the number three person in US government, Speaker of the Congress, Pelosi, visit Taiwan with a military airplane, that's a very obvious violation of America's own one China policy. And also worse, that encourages Taiwan independence forces on the island to challenge China's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Of course, China as a major partner will not tolerate this. So that's why China launches a huge military exercise as a deterrent.
Yeah, well, no one really cared about the exercise. No one really cared much.
Of course, if China really wants to use force to attack Taiwan, did already, because Chinese military forces already entered the so-called 12 miles territory line and the closest 9 miles. And we don't see any American military over there. It's kind of strange. So that tells you exactly that China wants peace, not war. As for the RMB pay for the oil, I think that if you are to blame, the first one should blame the United States, try to weaponize the dollars, try to punish others. For example, they use US dollars, use the payment, SWIFT, try to sanction against Russia. If United States try to use US dollars, which is a global currency, global credible currency, to weaponize it for political purposes, of course, that send a very chilly message to everyone who use US dollars, because they could be a victim next round, because United States can use dollars to punish them. That's number one. Number two, we all know that ever since 2008, the credibility of US dollars never been recovered. After all those years, United States just keep printing out the dollars without any kind of limit. They call it QEC, it's kind of no limitation. In other words, United States try to take full advantage of United States dollars as US dollars as a global currency to exploit other countries, including Saudis and others. All of this, of course, gave very strong incentive. Number one, to have alternative payment. Number two, to prevent or preempt being, taken advantage by United States, especially when weaponization of dollars has become so kind of irresponsible behavior of the United States. And I think that is truly understandable, both from political, strategic, and, of course, economic point of view.
I mean, as for that military display, it wasn't much covered in European capitals anyway, and in the United States. And you think those arguments will be persuasive to Antony Blinken, Samantha Power, that whole edifice of the military-industrial complex, when they have 400 bases circling China? They have proxies, arguably, in terms of South Korea, Japan, New Zealand, Australia, around China. They have warships routinely. Britain sends warships routinely around there. Meanwhile, those intellectual arguments are being made that all China is interested in is mutual prosperity and progress. Do you not see that there will be people in Washington who say, no, there has to be a red line here, and they won't be able to buy oil in currencies other than the dollar from Saudi Arabia?
I think on that part, I think that it's a pity that people in Washington, D.C. do not make the final call. I think Saudi is a sovereign state, so is China. It's a decision made by China and Saudis. If the two countries decided they want to have such exchange, and nobody really can intervene, and after all, this is the international community that everybody has a part in it. It is not a kind of everyone has to listen to the United States on this. Yes, it is a hegemon, but to some extent, it's a declining one, and number one. And number two, I think this is also good for the regional stability in terms of economic development and political stability. That's a good thing. And I think that it is not a kind of action that will undermine people's interest for the self-interest. It will actually be good for everyone. And as for, the red lines and so forth, first, I think that if you want to have a red line, you want to prevent others to not cross it. You have to define what your red line really is. The problem is that a lot of issues United States is a play the game of strategic ambiguity so that it can have the maximum is the flexibility and minimize the so-called commitment trap. If you play the game of strategic ambiguity, of course, others have also a kind of flexibility to play around. I think that's a fair game.
But you don't believe that those governments in the Arab world that are doing deals with China are in any danger? Saudi Arabia, the UAE, where I'm speaking to you from, for trying to enter this multipolar world? Because, as you know, for decades, they have been seen in Washington as compliant states with U.S. policy.
Yes, of course, there is a risk. And I think the people in Arabic countries, the leaders there, they are very rational and they are very wise ones. Again, they've proven that they've been making a very rational decisions. I think they fully understand, maybe better than you and me, about what risks really are. But they have to do this because after the explosion of Nord Stream 1 and 2, it seems that United States not only want to dominate or monopolize in the areas of security and economic development, they also want to establish a hegemon or dominance in the energy market, because if you blow out the line that send energies to Europe from Russia, then the Europe have to depend on the energy from Great Britain and Norway and the United States. In other way, the United States try to monopolize the supply and the demand of the energy market, which of course is very much a fundamental threat. We talk about threat, a fundamental threat to the Gulf countries, because they already agreed, say, look, it's good, and then use your money to price my products. That's fine. But if you want to determine, dominate which buyers can buy my oil or which country I can supply my product, that is a little too much. I think that's a fundamental reason for Saudis to give a cold shoulder to Joe Biden when President Biden visits there, because they want to make sure they're the one who make a decision. They're the one who decide, which countries they want to supply the energy, at what price they want to supply, and at what time, at what speed, at what volume they want to supply. They do not want United States to establish a kind of hegemony in this regard. There is an increasing gap between strategic desire of United States and its strategic capability. This gap is bigger and bigger. As a result, we see that what United States and its allies want to do cannot match up to what they actually able to do. And of course, countries in the Arab countries also see this. They see the weakness that they can take advantage of. And it is exactly this kind of gap between strategic desire and strategic capability that has undermined the stability in the region and beyond. I think when they try to strengthen or expand their cooperation and relationship with China, it's not just for economic gains, but also to kind of achieve a kind of political and economic stability, which is damaged by United States in the past decades.
Does it matter that analysis is not even understood as a dimension in which to contextualize modern politics in Western media? Does it even matter that so-called propaganda on NATO nation media speaks of the international community being against China, being against Russia, being against that famous meeting between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin in February, where China is willing to work with Russia to play a leading role in demonstrating the responsibility of major powers, is what Xi Jinping said. Minimized that kind of news, arguably, in NATO nation media, but what is being emphasized is China is turning against Russia, and apparently China is, threatening BRICS, I suppose, is the implication.
No, I think that there is some issues between Russia and China regarding this war going on in Ukraine. And I do not see that the two countries stand exactly on the same page. But those problems can be and should be solved through communications, and because the two countries do have a very solid common ground based on, number one, they have a similar concerns in terms of national security. They also have two economies are really compensate with each other. That's why China is very firmly refused to join the sanctions against Russia, and also China refused to condemn so-called Russia aggression, quote-unquote, into Ukraine. Having said that, I think China does have some common interests with West. And for this, Western media try to demonize China, I think the three kind of situations we have to distinguish carefully. Number one is caused by ignorance. Those people may never been to China. They also have this kind of conscious or subconscious prejudice against China or Chinese people as a nation. In other words, they need to be educated. A second kind of course, is those who have a very ill will against China. They do not see China doing good. They see China, as you mentioned, as an enemy, as a threat. They want China to go down and so on and so forth. In other words, they take a very hostile position or attitude against China.
Can I just ask you finally, of course, the pledge to support core interests seen as Ukraine and Taiwan made with Putin and Xi Jinping is seen in the West quite differently, especially with the increased amount of importation of energy resources from Russia, from China. Do you think the West will be, so-called West, will be successful in cleaving apart this alliance between Moscow and Beijing using Ukraine?
I think first and foremost, China and Russia has never get into a kind of alliance in terms of Western alliance. It's a partnership, strategic partnership. Of course, it is wishful thinking to separate Russia and China using the context of Ukraine war, because the two countries, like I said, do have very strong common interests. And also, we also know it's not only China. Other countries like South Africa, Brazil, and India, of course, all those countries refuse to join the sanctions against Russia. And as a matter of fact, you count every one of them. Only about 40 countries join the sanctions against Russia, which means it's a minority. So I think that the Ukraine war is a tragedy. We try to bring an end to it peacefully, of course. But that does not mean all those countries have to side with the United States and West against Russia, because there is a reason for this war. I think from China's point of view, the fundamental reason for this war is a Cold War mentality and the Cold War behavior. As long as United States and allies does not give up this kind of Cold War mentality and behavior, we're going to have more trouble down the road.
Professor Huang Jing, thank you. And that's it for the show. We'll be back next week with another brand new episode. But until then, you can still keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. But you can always head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you very soon.